This evening, we're continuing our overview of the book of Leviticus, and here in our study tonight, we find ourselves focusing on the final 17 verses of Leviticus chapter 7. But before we get into our text, I want to spend a few minutes reviewing what we've studied so far. In the first five chapters of this book, we found God's instructions regarding the five offerings that He commanded the children of Israel to bring to the tabernacle as an act of worship. And in Leviticus chapter 1, we found God's instructions to the children of Israel regarding the burnt offering. And we considered how God was leading them to worship Him with their wealth. Then in Leviticus chapter 2, we found God's instructions to the children of Israel regarding the grain offering. And we considered how God was leading them to worship Him with their work through the grain offering. Then in Leviticus chapter 3, we found God's instructions to the children of Israel regarding the peace offering. And we considered how God was using the peace offering to lead the children of Israel to worshiping Him within their community, resulting in communion with Him through their community. Then in Leviticus chapter 4, we found God's instructions to the children of Israel regarding the sin offering. And we considered how God was leading them to worship Him in all humility. Finally, in Leviticus chapters 5 and 6, we found God's instructions to the children of Israel regarding the trespass offering. And we considered how God was leading them through the trespass offering to worship Him with accountability and in all sincerity. Then we began the second half of chapter 6, and we watched as the Lord turned His attention from the children of Israel as a group, as a whole community. He turned His attention to Aaron and Aaron's sons, who are the priests of Israel. And the reason being is that the Lord had specific instructions for the priests regarding the right way to offer each of these sacrifices. And in light of the priestly instructions, we began to consider how the priests and the offerings were both symbols and shadows of the promised Messiah, Jesus Christ. So in the second half of chapter 6, we studied the priestly directions and we saw how Jesus fulfilled the law of the burnt offering, the law of the grain offering, and the law of the sin offering. Then in the first half of chapter 7, we again studied those priestly directions and we saw how Jesus fulfilled the law of the trespass offering and the law of the peace offering. Now, here in our text tonight, we're focusing on the final 17 verses of Leviticus chapter 7. And here in these verses, we find the Lord turning His attention back to the children of Israel in order to give them final instructions regarding the portions and the prohibitions of the peace offering. And so let's begin our overview here in verse 22. Of Leviticus chapter 7, where God once again revealed that the children of Israel were prohibited from eating the fat of the sacrifice. In Leviticus 7:22, it says, "The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Speak to the children of Israel, saying, you shall not eat any fat of ox or sheep or goat, and the fat of an animal that dies naturally, and the fat of what is torn by wild beasts, may be used in any other way, but you shall by no means eat it. For whoever eats the fat of the animal of which men offer an offering made by fire to the Lord, the person who eats it shall be cut off from his people.'" Here in these verses, we find God restating and further developing the prohibition regarding the consumption of the fat of the peace offering. So before we get into these verses to better understand what God is saying here, we ought to look back to Leviticus chapter 3, where the Lord first revealed that the fat of the peace offering belonged to Him. It was His portion. It's in Leviticus chapter 3. The Lord was revealing the right regulations regarding the ox, the sheep, or the goat that would be sacrificed as a peace offering. And after describing the way in which the fat would be removed and then prepared to be offered, the Lord declared in verse 16 of Leviticus chapter 3, "The priest shall burn them on the altar as food, an offering made by fire for a sweet aroma. All the fat is the Lord's. This shall be a perpetual statute throughout your generations in all your dwellings. You shall eat neither fat nor blood." And so we see that there was a prohibition on eating the fat of the peace offering due to the fact that the fat was the Lord's portion. It belonged to God. Now, with this in mind, let's return to Leviticus chapter 7, where the Lord was further instructing the children of Israel regarding the fat of the peace offering. You see, there in verse 23, when the Lord commanded them to abstain from eating the fat of the ox, the sheep, or the goat, He was prohibiting them from taking the portion of the sacrifice that truly belonged to Him. Now, we should understand that this portion, this prohibition, actually, of eating the portion that belonged to God, it didn't apply to every clean animal. When He's saying, don't eat the fat of this animal, this sheep or this ox or this goat, it's not a prohibition against every clean animal. As a matter of fact, there were many clean animals that the children of Israel were allowed to enjoy the fat of, including the deer. They could have the fat of the deer. They could eat the fat that's on the duck or the elk. Or how about that delicious ibex? Nothing like some good ibex. There were many clean animals that the Lord allowed them to have the fat and prepared with the meat. When we get to Leviticus chapter 11, we're going to learn more about the differences between the clean and the unclean animals. But for now, we just need to understand that the children of Israel were allowed to eat the fat of every clean animal except for the fat of the peace offering and the fat of the animals that died of natural causes or were killed out in the wild. Check out verse 24 again. There in Leviticus 7:24 says, "And the fat of any animal that dies naturally and the fat of what is torn by wild beasts may be used in any other way, but you shall by no means eat it." Now, we should understand that this rule not only applied to the fat of the animal that was killed naturally, and not only to the fat of the animal that was killed by wild beasts, but any animal that died naturally or was killed by another wild beast, the entire animal was unclean. Leviticus 22 verse 8 says, "Whatever dies naturally or is torn by beasts, he shall not eat to defile himself with it. I am the Lord." So if an Israelite went to check on his herds and flocks and discovered that one of his animals had died that night, he wasn't allowed to then take it home, clean it, prepare it, and eat it. No. That was off limits. Or if an Israelite found a clean dead animal in the wilderness that had been killed by another animal, the remains of the carcass was no longer edible. Not allowed to eat roadkill. Nope, couldn't do it. When we get to Leviticus chapter 22, we'll spend more time considering this roadkill rule. But for now, I want to continue focusing on the law that prohibited the children of Israel from eating the fat of the offerings, the peace offerings specifically, made unto the Lord. Check out verse 25 again. There in Leviticus 7:25, it says, "For whoever eats the fat of the animal of which men offer an offering made by fire to the Lord, the person who eats it shall be cut off from his people." While this prohibition began as a rule applied to the peace offering, the Lord obviously wanted to be clear that the fat of any offering was off limits to the children of Israel. And those who dared to eat the fat of the sacrificed animal would then be cut off from his people. And not only the fat, the blood also. The blood of every animal was prohibited. Check out verse 26. It says there, "Moreover, you shall not eat any blood in any of your dwellings, whether of bird or beast. Whoever eats any blood, that person shall be cut off from his people." Here in these verses we discover that the consumption of the blood of any animal was strictly prohibited. And we see why in Leviticus chapter 17. Hold your place here in Leviticus chapter 7. Turn over to Leviticus chapter 17. Because in Leviticus 17, we find this prohibition presented with a bit more explanation. So check out Leviticus 17, beginning there in verse 10. There in verse 10, it says, "And whatever man of the house of Israel, or of the strangers who dwell among you, who eats any blood, I will set my face against that person who eats blood, and will cut him off from among his people. For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it to you upon the altar to make atonement for your souls, for it is the blood that makes atonement for the soul." So we see here that God intended blood to be used for the purpose of providing atonement. Or in other words, it was the price paid for the forgiveness of sins. And since God intended that the blood would be used for such a holy ordinance as this, those who carelessly consume the blood of an animal would then be cut off from the nation of Israel. Now I should point out that this warning about being cut off from their people, it's found four times in Leviticus chapter 7. And while God intended for the peace offering to result in communion in community, the peace offering was designed to bring Israel together before God, and everybody taking a portion of the animal, everyone would get to consume and enjoy the animal. It was designed to result in communion in community. But God also insisted that those who broke these prohibitions of eating the blood or eating the fat, they would face exclusion from the privileges of Israel and division from the community of God's people, as well as division from communion with God Himself. As we consider this Levitical prohibition, as we consider this rule to abstain from eating any blood, we must ask, why in the world did Jesus command the Jews to drink His blood? What was He thinking? When Jesus told the Jews that they needed to drink His blood, He had to have known that these people would kind of freak out at that statement. If you would turn to John chapter 6 and let's consider what Jesus meant when He told the Jews that they needed to drink His blood. Continue, hold your place there in Leviticus 7. We'll come back to it. But let's turn to John chapter 6, because in John chapter 6, we find Jesus surrounded by a multitude of Jews who insisted that He show them a miracle. Kind of like when God provided manna in the desert, they said. Can you do something like that? Well, Jesus responded to their request by declaring, I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread that I shall give is my flesh, which I shall give for the life of the world. But then in verse 52, in John 6:52, John revealed that the Jews who heard this, who heard Jesus claiming to be the bread that actually came down from heaven, they were offended. They began to quarrel amongst themselves. There in John 6:52, it says, the Jews therefore quarreled among themselves, saying, how can this man give us his flesh to eat? Then Jesus said to them, most assuredly, I say to you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink His blood, you have no life in you. Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up at the last day. For my flesh is food indeed, and my blood is drink indeed. He who eats my flesh and drinks my blood abides in me, and I in him. As the living Father sent me, and I live because of the Father, so he who feeds on me will live because of me. This is the bread which came down from heaven. Not as your fathers ate the manna and are dead. He who eats this bread will live forever. These things He said in the synagogue as He taught in Capernaum. Therefore, many of His disciples, when they heard this, said, this is a hard saying. Who can understand it? Now, I can't help but to consider this method of teaching that Jesus is using. I can't help but to wonder, was there a better way to present His point? Was there a better way that He could have taught this, maybe with a bit more clarity? Certainly, people were left completely confused or completely offended. Was there a better way that He could have taught this? And the answer is yes. I believe that there was a clearer way to present this. Jesus could have presented His point with more clarity if clarity was in fact His goal. If He was teaching this for the sake of clarity, then there would have been a better way to put it. But I don't believe that clarity was His goal. Therefore, since His doctrine about drinking His blood seemed to be so contrary, so offensive in comparison to the Levitical law, I must assume that this teaching was a test that was designed to divide the true followers of Christ from the phony followers. As a matter of fact, in John 6:66, John reported that many of the so-called disciples stopped following Him after hearing this teaching. Many people stopped following Him. Then He turned to His 12 and said, are you going to leave me too? Peter asked, where are we going to go? Good question. But we see how those people who were following Christ, the multitudes of people, most of them left. They were exposed as being phony followers. Those who continued to follow him by faith, though they didn't understand the teaching, eventually, because they followed him by faith, they learned in the upper room that he was allegorically alluding to that custom of communion that Christians experience after they believe in Christ. Listen, Jesus wasn't talking about his literal blood and his literal body. No, God had already revealed in Leviticus chapter 7 that the consumption of blood is sin. Therefore, he was simply speaking of the symbolic celebration that believers enjoy at communion. The symbols of what he really did when he offered his body as a sacrifice, when he spilt his blood for our forgiveness. And so I believe that, well, this was a test that Jesus was using to expose those who were following him for the wrong reasons. Now, with this in mind, if you would, turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Because in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, Paul revealed how God continues to use these divisions to separate the true followers from the phony. In 1 Corinthians 11, Paul was about to address the issues that were arising over the very same issue, communion. And the communion confusion that was there in Corinth, Paul wanted to address. But before presenting the proper protocol for partaking of communion, Paul revealed how these divisions actually serve a purpose in the church. In 1 Corinthians 11, looking at verse 18, it says, "For first of all, when you come together as a church, I hear that there are divisions among you, and in part I believe it. For there must also be factions among you, that those who are approved may be recognized among you." You see, Paul was telling the Christians there in Corinth that the divisions and the factions that occur in the church, they're a surefire way of discovering those who are the true followers of Christ and those who are the phony. Now, mind you, that it's not our job to pluck up the tares that are among the wheat and cast them out. No, that's not the point. But there should be a process of understanding who are the leaders who have been approved by God and who are the ones who are causing the division. We have to understand that the phony followers are constantly offended by the teachings of Jesus. They're just constantly offended by it. They're constantly arguing about it. And then they use those offenses and they create divisions in the church by their offense. Christian, we should be careful. We should be careful when someone comes to us offended and complaining about this person or that person, and that leader said this, and now I'm offended, and now I'm going to try to get everybody against that guy or that girl. And man, when that starts happening, you've got a division on your hands. And the division is there so that those who have been approved by God may be recognized among us. It's possible that when people come offended and complaining, that it's possible that you're dealing with a phony follower whose only desire is to cause division in the church. Therefore, we ought to heed the words of Paul, who declared that there must be factions among you, that those who are approved may be recognized among you. Christian, don't end up cut off from your own Christian community because you tasted the bad blood of a phony follower. One way that we can avoid falling victim to divisive people is by supporting the leaders that God has approved. We can support the leadership that God has appointed. And we find an example of this. Let's go back to Leviticus chapter 7 and consider the way that the Lord directed the children of Israel to support the Levitical priesthood. In Leviticus 7:28, after God is saying, "Don't fall victim to tasting this blood and being cut off from your people. Rather, come to the priests and offer your sacrifices." Look at verse 28. "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Speak to the children of Israel, saying, He who offers the sacrifice of his peace offering to the Lord shall bring his offering to the Lord from the sacrifice of his peace offering. His own hands shall bring the offerings made by fire to the Lord. The fat with the breast he shall bring, that the breast may be waved as a wave offering before the Lord. And the priest shall burn the fat on the altar, but the breast shall be Aaron's and his sons.'" Here in verse 30, we're reminded that each person was commanded to bring the offerings made by fire to the Lord with his own hands. It was with his own hands. In other words, God was calling the Israelites to personally acknowledge their sinfulness, and their need for that leadership, the priests, in their lives. And so they had to personally hand deliver the sacrifice to the priests. And after the fat was removed and presented to the Lord, the priest would then receive the breast of the wave offering. Now, as I read about this wave offering, I can't help but to imagine the entire nation of Israel gathered around the altar. And they're worshiping God with their offerings. And all of a sudden, on this side of the altar, the wave breaks out. And everybody starts doing this all the way around. That would be awesome if that was like the wave offering. But that's not what we're talking about here. Actually, the priest would take the breast of the sacrificial animal and would like actually wave it from side to side. He would take this breast and wave it from side to side. And I can't help but to consider how there's a suggestion of the heart of fellowship there as the horizontal direction of this wave was from side to side, representing how our hearts ought to be knit together in earthly fellowship. Then in Leviticus 7:32, it says, "Also the right thigh you shall give to the priest as a heave offering from the sacrifices of your peace offerings. He among the sons of Aaron who offers the blood of the peace offering and the fat shall have the right thigh for his part." In other words, after offering the blood and the fat of the peace offering, the priest would then take the right thigh of the sacrifice and heave it into the air a few times from bottom to top, going up and down. I believe that this possibly symbolizes the importance of us as a community walking together in communion with God as that right thigh is being heaved up and down. I believe that these were pictures of the community in communion that ought to be occurring there with the children of Israel as the peace offering was being offered. God was using the peace offering to bring the children of Israel together in community and then experiencing communion with God as the offering was being sacrificed. And just so that there was no confusion, the Lord declared again that that wave offering and the heave offering belonged to the priests. Check out Leviticus 7:34 again. It says, "For the breast of the wave offering and the thigh of the heave offering I have taken from the children of Israel, from the sacrifices of their peace offerings, and I have given them to Aaron the priest and to his sons from the children of Israel by a statute forever. This is the consecrated portion for Aaron and his sons from the offerings made by fire to the Lord on the day when Moses presented them to minister to the Lord as priests. The Lord commanded this to be given to them by the children of Israel on the day that he anointed them by a statute forever throughout their generations." And then here we find in the last two verses a postscript to all of these chapters. "This is the law of the burnt offering, the grain offering, the sin offering, the trespass offering, the consecrations, and the sacrifice of the peace offering, which the Lord commanded Moses on Mount Sinai on the day when he commanded the children of Israel to offer their offerings to the Lord in the wilderness of Sinai." Now, before we conclude our study of Leviticus chapter 7, I want to take another look at real quick at verse 35, where the Lord declared that the breast and the right thigh were the consecrated portions for the priests. That word consecrated can also mean appointed. And so there was this appointed portion of meat for the anointed priests of Israel. An appointed portion of meat for the men that God had appointed to the work of the ministry. Now, as we consider this appointed portion of meat, we must remember that the peace offering, well, it was a free will offering. It wasn't required. People brought it of their own free will. And yet the Lord certainly encouraged the children of Israel to recognize and support those anointed priests through the wave offering and the heave offering. When they came seeking community and communion, they had to recognize the leaders of the community that they found themselves in. And that's part of the design of this peace offering. It was designed to initiate peace from man to man and from man to God. With this in mind, we should consider this in light of the encouragement of Paul regarding the way that Christians ought to also recognize the leaders that God has appointed in the church. And so if you would, turn to 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. Because it's in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, we find Paul writing to the Christians in Thessalonica. And as he was bringing this letter to the church in Thessalonica to a close, he presented them with a few important exhortations regarding the correct Christian conduct when it comes to the appointed church leaders. And here in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, look with me at verse 12. Paul writes, "And we urge you, brethren, to recognize those who labor among you and are over you in the Lord and admonish you, and to esteem them very highly in love for their work's sake. Be at peace among yourselves." Now, we have to recognize here that the word recognize found in verse 12, it means to have regard for one, or to cherish someone, or to pay attention to someone. And so Paul was saying, pay attention to those who labor among you and those who are over you. In other words, those who are leaders over you, who are also serving among you. See, he's not talking about those who are lording it over you. He's talking about those who are serving amongst you, but are actually structure-wise leaders over you. Pay attention to them. Pay attention to them. Have regard for them. Cherish them. He's saying have high regard for those who serve through godly guidance and exhortation. Those who are bringing the godly guidance to you, those who are exhorting you to walk in the Lord, pay attention to them. Have high regard for them. Cherish them. Furthermore, the word esteem found there in verse 13, it speaks of respect and admiration. And the phrase there in verse 13, very highly, well, it speaks of exceeding abundance. It's like hyperabounding in. And so we're supposed to be hyper-abounding or have an exceeding abundance of respect and admiration for the church leaders that God has appointed. And that we're supposed to have that exceeding abundant amount of agape love for them. Now, let me just stop here for a moment and realize. I realize that this exhortation, this text that I'm taking you to, it directly relates to the relationship between the pastor and the parishioner. And so let me assure you just very quickly that it's not my plan to exploit these verses to my own personal benefit. That's not my point. I'm not going to tell you to bring, you know, the breast and the thigh over to the house so that I can grill up the meat and stuff like that. That's not my point. I'm not begging for brisket up here, okay? But at the same time, I do want us to recognize the way that the Lord has designed the structure of leadership of the church. The Lord has appointed leaders who have been ordained for the protection of the church. Because there are tares among the wheat. There are those Christians who have left the path of God and who are causing division. There are Christians who aren't healthy in their walk and they might be attempting to hurt others. There are unbelievers amongst us who they might be here simply to cause division in the church. There might be those who have been planted by the enemy just to wreak havoc on the church. And God has appointed leaders in the church, not unlike He appointed priests for the children of Israel. Now, we certainly don't need to go back to some priestly ceremony where offerings are being offered. No, we've already seen that Jesus has fulfilled all of the offerings. He has fulfilled the law. And still yet, a structure of leadership has been appointed for the protection of the church. Check out 1 Thessalonians 5 again. Look there again at verse 12 because it says, "And we urge you, brethren, to recognize those who labor among you and are over you in the Lord and admonish you, and to esteem them very highly in love for their work's sake. Be at peace among yourselves." Notice here that the peace of the church, the peace that ought to be happening within a fellowship, is directly related to the way in which its members recognize and respect the appointed leaders. It's so easy to hear a leader say, "Well, I need to challenge you in this way. I need to check on your walk over here because I see that you might be struggling in this area. And so let me encourage you in this." Or maybe as a pastor, I stand up here and I teach something that really just kind of challenges your heart. And our first fleshly reaction, the knee-jerk reaction of our flesh is, "Well, who are they to tell me? Who is that leader to say this? What right do they have?" It's always our first fleshly knee-jerk reaction. Oh, Americans, we love our autonomy. We love to call the shots in our life. And most people don't get it. They don't get a clue about how that God has appointed church leaders for the protection and for the health of the church. Now, we will be talking in a few weeks about what we do when the leaders who have been raised up all of a sudden go wrong and start leading incorrectly, leading not according to the Word of God. That's certainly a possible scenario that we have to consider, and we will. But we must understand that just because there have been and are currently and will be in the future bad Christian leaders doesn't mean that we just need to avoid Christian leadership altogether. Doesn't mean we throw the baby out with the bathwater. You see, the leadership of the church has been appointed by God for the health and for the protection of the church. So that when there are those who come in and clearly are causing division, church leadership is there to say, this is going to be brought to an end. The sad thing is, there are some Christians who will rather follow the naysayer and the complainer and the one that was offended by the teachings of Christ, rather than their leaders, rather than listening to the appointed church leaders. So we see then that there's a peace that results in the church when Christians are listening to the leaders that God has appointed. The peace of the church is directly related to the way in which its members recognize and respect the appointed leaders. And so my encouragement to you as we close this study is this. Like the children of Israel, Christians should choose to freely support the appointed leadership. Christians should choose to freely. Remember, it's that free will offering. It's not required. It's not commanded. But there is that free will offering. That freeness of coming and just saying, you know what? I'm going to believe in God. I'm going to believe and trust in God that He's raised up these men and women to lead this church. I'm going to trust that. Believe that He can take care of it if it's wrong, if it's off. If this leader needs a spanking, God's a big God. He's got a big belt. He can discipline His children. He can take care of the problems. And so like the children of Israel, my encouragement, Christians, is that we should freely support our appointed leaders. And in that, there will be peace in the church. And the result of that is a healthy community of believers who are experiencing communion with God. Let's pray.